New York by James Fenimore Cooper. Text transcribed and annotated by Hugh McDougall, founder and secretary treasurer of the James Fenimore Cooper Society, who will appreciate corrections and comments at jfcooper@bcom. All material not from Cooper's text is enclosed in curly brackets. Introductory note. In 1851, just before his death on the eve of his 62nd birthday, James Fenimore Cooper was working a history of New York City, for which he planned the title of The Towns of Manhattan. Cooper never completed it, and most of the parts of the manuscript that he did complete were destroyed in a fire at the printers after his death. The introduction to the work, however, survived, and was published during the Civil War in the spirit of the age, New York. April 5, 1864, a fundraising publication of the American Sanitary Commission, predecessor of the American Red Cross, substantial excerpts were reprinted, as James Fenimore Cooper on Secession and States' Rights in the Continental Monthly, devoted to literature and national policy, Vol. 6, Number 1, July 1864, pages 79-83. The period of the H text was much later reprinted in book form under the title of New York, New York. William Farquhar Payson, 1930, in a limited edition of 750 copies, with an introduction by Dixon Ryan Fox, and was later reissued in facsimile form, Folcroft. Pennsylvania, Folcroft Library Editions, 1973, in a limited edition of 100 copies from which this text is taken. A few other surviving fragments from The Towns of Manhattan were compiled in James F. Beard Jr. The First of Greater New York. Unknown portions of Fenimore Cooper's last work, New York Historical Society Quarterly, Vol. XXXVII, Number 2, pages 10945. April 1953. The text has been transcribed as written, except that because of the limitations of the Gutenberg format, occasional words in italics have been transcribed in all capitals. Annotations identified by curly brackets have been occasionally added, identifying allusions, translating foreign terms, and correcting a few obvious typographical errors. Introduction from The Spirit of the Fair, April 5, 1864, unpublished MS. of James Fenimore Cooper. Our national novelist died in the autumn of 1856. Previous to his fatal illness, he was engaged upon a historical work, to be entitled The Man Sick of Manhattan, only the introduction to which had been sent to the press. The printing office was destroyed by fire, and with it the opening chapters of this work. Fortunately, a few pages had been set up, and the impression sent to a literary gentleman, then editor of a popular critical journal, and were thus saved from destruction. To him we are indebted for the posthumous articles of Cooper, wherewith, by a coincidence as remarkable as it is auspicious, we now enrich our columns with a contribution from the American Pioneer in Letters. In discussing the growth of New York and speculating on her future destiny, the patriotic and sagacious author seems to have anticipated the terrible crisis through which the nation is now passing. There is a prescience in the views he expresses, which is all the more impressive inasmuch as they are uttered by a voice now silenced forever. They have a solemn interest, and were inspired by a genuine sympathy in the progress and prosperity of the nation. It should be remembered that, when these observations were written, the public mind had been and was still highly excited by the compromise measures, the last vain expedient, to propitiate the traitors who have since filled the land with the horrors of civil war. New York, the increase of the towns of Manhattan, as, for the sake of convenience, we shall term New York and her adjuncts, in all that contributes to the importance of a great commercial mart, renders them one of the most remarkable places of the present age. Within the distinct recollections of living men, they have grown from a city of the fifth or sixth class, to be near the head of all the purely trading places of the known world. That there are sufficient causes for this unparalleled prosperity will appear in the analysis of the natural advantages of the port in its position, security, accessories, and scale. The state of New York had been steadily advancing in population, resources, and power ever since the peace of 1785. At that time it bore but a secondary rank among what were then considered the great states of the Confederacy. Massachusetts, proper and singly, then outnumbered us, while New England, collectively, must have had some 6 or 7 times our people. A very few years of peace, however, brought material changes. In 1790, the year in which the first census under the law of Congress was taken, the state already contained 140,120 souls, while New England had a few more than 1,000,000. It is worthy of remark that, 60 years since, the entire state had but little more than half of the population of the Manhattanese towns at the present moment. Each succeeding census diminished these proportions, until that of 1830, when the return for the state of New York gave 1,372,812, and for New England 1,954,709. At this time, and for a considerable period preceding and succeeding it, it was found that the proportion between the people of the state of New York and the people of the city was about as 10 to 1. Between 1830 and 1840, the former had so far increased in numbers as to possess as many people as all New England. In the next decade, this proportion was exceeded. And the late returns show that New York, singly, has passed ahead of all her enterprising neighbors in that section of the Union. At the same time, the old proportion between the state and the town, or, to be more accurate, the towns on the Bay of New York and its waters has been entirely lost, 5 to 1, being near the truth at the present moment. It is easy to foresee that the time is not very distant when 2 to 1 will be maintained with difficulty, as between the state and its commercial capital. Bold as the foregoing prediction may seem, the facts of the last half century will, we think, justify it. If the Manhattan towns, or Manhattan, as we shall not scruple to term the several places that compose the prosperous sisterhood at the mouth of the Hudson, a name that is more ancient and better adapted to the history, associations, and convenience of the place than any other, continue to prosper as they have done, ere the close of the present century they will take their station among the capitals of the first rank. It may require a longer period to collect the accessories of a first-class place, for these are the products of time and cultivation, though the facilities of intercourse, the spirit of the age, and the equalizing sentiment that marks the civilization of the epoch will greatly hasten everything in the shape of improvement. New York will probably never possess any churches of an architecture to attract attention for their magnitude and magnificence. The policy of the country, which separates religion from the state, precludes this by confining all the expenditures of this nature to the several parishes, few of which are rich enough to do more than erect edifices of moderate dimensions and cost. The Romish Church, so much addicted to addressing the senses, manifests some desire to construct its cathedrals, but they are necessarily confined to the limits and ornaments suited to the resources of a branch of the church that, in this country, is by no means affluent. The manner in which the Americans are subdivided into sects also conflicts with any commendable desire that may exist to build glorious temples in honor of the deity. And convenience is more consulted than taste, perhaps, in all that relates to ecclesiastical architecture. Nevertheless, a sensible improvement in this respect has occurred within the last few years, to which we shall elsewhere advert. It will be in their trade, their resources, their activity, and their influence on the rest of the world, as well as in their population, that the towns of Manhattan will be first entitled to rank with the larger capitals of Europe. So obvious, rapid, and natural has been the advance of all the places, that it is not easy for the mind to regard anything belonging to them as extraordinary or out of rule. There is not a port in the whole country that is less indebted to art and the fostering hand of government than this. It is true certain forts, most of them of very doubtful necessity, have been constructed for defense, but no attack having ever been contemplated, or, if contemplated, attempted, they have been dead letters in the history of its progress. We are not aware that government has ever expended 1 cent in the waters of Manhattan, except for the surveys, construction of the aforesaid military works, and the erection of the lighthouses that form a part of the general provision for the safe navigation of the entire coast. Some money has been expended for the improvement of the shallow waters of the Hudson, but it has been as much, or more, for the advantage of the upper towns, and the trade coastwise, generally, than for the special benefit of New York. The immense natural advantages of the bays and islands at the mouth of the Hudson have, in a great degree, superseded the necessity of such assistance. Nature has made every material provision for a mart of the first importance. And perhaps it has been fortunate that the towns have been left, like healthful and vigorous children, managed by prudent parents, to take the inclination and growth pointed out to them by the safest and best of guides. London is indebted to artificial causes, in a great degree, for its growth and power. That great law of trade, which renders settling places indispensable, has contributed to her prosperity and continued ascendancy, long after the day when rival ports are carrying away her fleets and commerce. She is a proof of the difficulty of shaking a commercial superiority long established. Scarce a cargo that enters the ports of the kingdom that does not pay tribute to her bankers or merchants. But London is a political capital, and that in a country where the representation of the government is more imposing, possessing greater influence than in any other Christian nation. The English aristocracy, which wields the real authority of the state, here makes its annual exhibition of luxury and wealth, such as the world has never beheld anywhere else, ancient Rome possibly excepted, and has had a large share in rendering London what it is. New York has none of this adventitious aid. Both of the governments, that of the United States and that of the state, have long been taken from her, leaving her nothing of this sort but her own local authorities. But representation forms no part of the machinery of American policy. It is supposed that man is too intellectual and philosophical to need it in this intellectual and philosophical country, par excellence. Although such is the theory, the whole struggle in private life is limited to the impression made by representation in the hands of individuals. That which the government has improvidently cast aside, society has seized upon. And hundreds who have no claim to distinction beyond the possession of money, profit by the mistake, to place themselves in positions perhaps that they are not always exactly qualified to fill. Of all social usurpations, that of mere money is the least tolerable, as one may have a very full purse with empty brains and vulgar tastes and habits. The wisdom of thus throwing the control of a feature of society that is of much more moment than is commonly supposed into the chapter of commercial accidents may well be questioned. Some crude attempts have been made to bring the circles of New York within the control of a code prepared and promulgated through the public press. They who have made these abortive attempts have been little aware of the power with which they have to contend. Napoleon himself, who could cause the conscription to enter every man's dwelling, could not bring the coteries of the faubourg under his influence. In this respect, society will make its own laws, appeal to its own opinions, and submit only to its own edicts. Association is beyond the control of any regular and peaceful government, resting on influences that seem, in a great measure, to be founded in nature the most inflexible of all rulers. Tastes, conditions, connections, habits, and even prejudices unite to form a dynasty that never has yet been dethroned. New York is nearer to a state of nature, probably, as regards all its customs and associations, than any other well-established place that could be named. With 600,000 souls, collected from all parts of Christendom with no upper class recognized by, or in any manner connected with, the institutions, it would seem that the circles might enact their own laws, and the popular principle be brought to bear socially on the usages of the town, referring fashion and opinion altogether to a sort of popular will. The result is not exactly what might be expected under the circumstances, the past being intermingled with the present time, in spite of theories and various opposing interests, and, in many instances, caprice is found to be stronger than reason. Conscription equals the military draft. The Faubourg equals the fashionable neighborhoods of Paris. The popular principle equals democracy. We have no desire to exaggerate, or to color beyond their claims, the importance of the towns of Manhattan. No one can better understand the vast chasm which still exists between London and New York, and how much the latter has to achieve, before she can lay claim to be the counterpart of that metropolis of Christendom. It is not so much our intention to dilate on existing facts, as to offer a general picture, including the past, the present, and the future, that may aid the mind in forming something like a just estimate of the real importance and probable destinies of this emporium of the New World. It is now just 23 years since that, in another work, we ventured to predict the great fortunes that were in reserve for this American mart, giving some of the reasons that then occurred to us that had a tendency to produce such a result. These predictions drew down upon us sneers, not to say derision, in certain quarters, where nothing that shadows forth the growing power of this republic is ever received with favor. The intervening period has more than fulfilled our expectations. In this short interval, the population of the Manhattan towns has more than trebled, while their wealth and importance have probably increased in a greatly magnified proportion. Should the next quarter of a century see this ratio in growth continued, London would be very closely approached in its leading element of superiority numbers. We have little doubt that the present century will bring about changes that will place the emporium of the Old World and that of the New nearly on a level. This opinion is given with a perfect knowledge of the vast increase of the English capital itself, and with a due allowance for its continuance. We propose, in the body of this work, to furnish the reasons justifying these anticipations. Another work equals James Fenimore Cooper, Notions of the Americans. Picked up by a traveling bachelor, Philadelphia. Carey, Lee, and Carey, 1828. A detailed description, in the guise of letters written by a fictitious Belgian traveler, of the geography, history, economy, government, and culture of the United States. 17 years since, the writer returned home from a long residence in Europe, during which he had dwelt 4 years in many of the largest towns of that quarter of the world. At a convivial party in one of the most considerable dwellings in Broadway, the conversation turned on the great improvements that had then been made in the town, with sundry allusions that were intended to draw out the opinions of a traveler on a subject that justly ever has an interest with the Manhattanese. In that conversation, the writer his memory impressed with the objects with which he had been familiar in London and Paris, and Rome, Venice, Naples, etc., and feeling how very provincial was the place where he was, as well as its great need of change, to raise it to the level of European improvement, ventured to say that, in his opinion, speaking of Broadway, there was not a building in the whole street, a few special cases excepted, that would probably be standing 30 years hence. The writer has reason to know that this opinion was deemed extravagant, and was regarded as a consequence of European, rather than of American reasoning. If the same opinion were uttered today, it would meet with more respect. Buildings now stand in Broadway that may go down to another century, for they are on a level with the wants and tastes of a capital, but none such, with a single exception, existed at the time of which we are writing. 17 years since equals Cooper had returned to New York in November 1833, after a 7-year sojourn in Europe, and these facts are to be found the explanation of the want of ancient edifices in America. 2 centuries and a half are no very remote antiquity, but we should regard buildings of that, or even of a much less age, with greater interest, did the country possess them. But nothing was constructed a century since that was worth preserving on account of its intrinsic merits, and, before time can throw its interest around them, edifice after edifice comes down, to make way for a successor better suited to the wants and tastes of the age. In this respect, New York is even worse off than the other ancient places of the country. Ancient as things can be regarded in America, its great growth and commercial spirit demanding sacrifices that Philadelphia and Boston have as yet escaped. It is quite within the scope of probable things that, in a very few years, there should not be standing in the old town a single structure of any sort that was there previously to the Revolution. As for the new towns, Brooklyn, Williamsburg, etc., they had no existence worth alluding to anterior to the commencement of the present century. If any dwelling is to be found within the limits of either that can claim a more remote origin, it is some farmhouse that has been swallowed up by the modern improvements. That which is true of the towns, in this respect, is equally true of the whole country. A dwelling that has stood half a century is regarded as a sort of specimen of antiquity, and one that has seen twice that number of years, of which a few are to be found, especially among the descendants of the Dutch, is looked upon with some such reverence as is felt by the modern traveler in gazing at the tomb of Cecilia Metella, or the amphitheater of Verona. Tomb of Cecilia Metella equals the most famous monument on the Appian Way outside Rome, commemorating the wife of Crassus, d. 53 BC, who as member of the First Triumvirate, joined with Caesar and Pompey, to end the Roman Republic. Amphitheater of Verona equals built by the Emperor Diocletian about 290 AD. The stage gladiator combats. It is one of the largest surviving Roman amphitheaters. The world has had a striking example of the potency of commerce as opposed to that of even the sword, in the abortive policy of Napoleon, to exclude England from the trade of the continent. At the very moment that this potentate of unequaled means and iron rule was doing all he could to achieve his object, the goods of Manchester found their way into half of his dependent provinces, and the Thames was crowded with shipping which belonged to states that the emperor supposed to be under his control. Abortive policy equals in the early years of the 19th century the French Emperor Napoleon had sought, largely unsuccessfully, to blockade England from trade with Europe, as to the notion of there arising any rival ports, south, to compete with New York, it strikes us as a chimera. New Orleans will always maintain a qualified competition with every place not washed by the waters of the Great Valley, but New Orleans is nothing but a local port, after all of great wealth and importance, beyond a doubt, but not the mart of America. New York is essentially national in interests, position, and pursuits. No one thinks of the place as belonging to a particular state, but to the United States. The revenue paid into the treasury, at this point, comes in reality from the pockets of the whole country, and belongs to the whole country. The same is true of her sales and their proceeds. Indeed, there is very little political sympathy between the places at the mouth of the Hudson and the interior. The vulgar prejudice of envy and the jealousy of the power of collected capital, causing the country to distrust the town. We are aware that the governing motive of commerce all over the world is the love of gain. It differs from the love of gain in its lower aspects, merely in its greater importance and its greater activity. These cause it to be more engrossing among merchants than among the tillers of the soil. Still, Facts prove that this state of things has many relieving shades. The man who is accustomed to deal in large sums is usually raised above the more sordid vices of covetousness and avarice in detail. There are rich misers, certainly, but they are exceptions. We do not believe that the merchant is one tittle more mercenary than the husbandman in his motives, while he is certainly much more liberal of his gains. One deals in thousands, the other in tens and twenties. It is seldom, however, that a failing market, or a sterile season, drives the owner of the plow to desperation, and his principles, if he have any, may be preserved. While the losses or risks of an investment involving more than the merchant really owns, suspend him for a time on the tenter hooks of commercial doubt. The man thus placed must have more than a common share of integrity, to reason right when interest tempts him to do wrong. Notwithstanding the generally fallacious character of the governing motive of all commercial communities, there is much to mitigate its selfishness. The habit of regarding the entire country and its interests with a friendly eye, and of associating themselves with its fortunes, liberalizes its mind and wishes, and confers a Catholic spirit that the capital of a mere province does not possess. Boston, for instance, is leagued with Lowell, and Lawrence, and Cambridge, and seldom acts collectively without betraying its provincial mood. While New York receives her goods and her boasted learning by large trans shipments, without any special consciousness of the transactions. This habit of generalizing in interests encourages the Catholic spirit mentioned, and will account for the nationality of the great mart of a great and much extended country. The feeling would be apt to endure through many changes, and keep alive the connection of commerce even after that of the political relations may have ceased. New York, at this moment, contributes her full share to the prosperity of London, though she owes no allegiance to St. James. The American Union, however, has much more adhesiveness than is commonly imagined. The diversity and complexity of its interests form a network that will be found, like the web of the spider, to possess a power of resistance far exceeding its gossamer appearance when strong enough to hold all that it was ever intended to enclose. The slave interest is now making its final effort for supremacy, and men are deceived by the throes of a departing power. The institution of domestic slavery cannot last. It is opposed to the spirit of the age. And the figments of Mr. Calhoun, in affirming that the territories belong to the states, instead of the government of the United States, and the celebrated doctrine of the equilibrium, for which we look in vain into the Constitution for a single sound argument to sustain it, are merely the expiring efforts of a reasoning that cannot resist the common sense of the nation. As it is healthful to exhaust all such questions, let us turn aside a moment to give a passing glance at this very material subject.
Calhoun equals Senator John C. Calhoun, 1782-1850, of South Carolina. At the time when the Constitution was adopted, three classes of persons were held to service in the country: apprentices, redemptioners, and slaves. The two first classes were by no means insignificant in 1789, and the redemptioners were rapidly increasing in numbers. In that day, it looked as if this speculative importation of laborers from Europe was to form a material part of the domestic policy of the northern states. Now the Negro is a human being, as well as an apprentice or a redemptioner, though the Constitution does not consider him as the equal of either. It is a great mistake to suppose that the Constitution of the United States, as it now exists, recognizes slavery in any manner whatever, unless it be to mark it as an interest that has less than the common claim to the ordinary rights of humanity. In the apportionment or representation clause, the redemptioner and the apprentice counts each as a man, whereas five slaves are enumerated as only three free men. The free black is counted as a man, in all particulars, and is represented as such, but his fellow in slavery has only 3/5 of his political value. This is the celebrated clause in which the Constitution is said to recognize slavery. To our view, the clause is perfectly immaterial in this sense, making the simple provision that so long as a state shall choose to keep a portion of her people in this subordinate condition, she shall enjoy only this limited degree of representation. To us, it appears to be a concession made to freedom, and not to slavery. There is no obligation, unless self-imposed, to admit any but a minority of her whites to the enjoyment of political power, aristocracy being, in truth, more closely assimilated to republicanism than democracy. Republicanism means the sovereignty of public things instead of that of persons, or the representation of the common interests, in lieu of those of a monarch. There is no common principle of popular sway recognized in the Constitution. In the government of the several states, monarchy is denounced, but democracy is nowhere proclaimed or insisted on. Marked differences in the degrees of popular control existed in the country in 1789, and though time is lessening them, are still to be found among us. The close consideration of all these facts, we feel persuaded, will give a coloring to some of the most important interests of the country, differing essentially from those that have been loosely adopted in the conflicts of parties, and many heresies appear to us to have crept into the political creed of the Republic, purely from the struggles of faction. When men have a specific and important purpose in view, it is but natural they should bend most of its collateral connections to the support of their own objects. We conceive that the Constitution has thus been largely misinterpreted, and they who live at the epoch of the renowned equilibrium and of the rights of the people of the sovereign states will have seen memorable examples of the truth of this position. The first popular error, then, that we shall venture to assail. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.